This is Bristol Bay and Beyond, KDLG's weekly news magazine. It's Friday, the 13th of January. I'm Dave Benninger. We're in good luck to have you with us today. Coming up in the next half hour, we'll get an update on a small outbreak of HIV in one of our communities, as well as some tips for healthy living this year. The doc says we all need to move more.
That is probably the biggest thing that a given person can do, aside from quitting smoking, to improve their health and well-being over the long run.
State Senator John Coghill joins to talk about SB 91, the criminal justice reforms he sponsored, and what fixes still need to be addressed next session. Plus, one now former felon tells us about completing her probation and leaving the conviction behind.
If I can do this, do a mistake, learn from it, you know, complete my probation, everything like that, of course, absolutely someone else can do this.
We'll talk with a few mushers about why they're keeping up the tradition in Bristol Bay and catch up with a few of the Christmas and New Year's revelers making the rounds this week.
The slavicking is completely different from the old time. It's more modern. You're running around in cars and snow machines instead of dog teams.
Those stories are coming up after a look back at some of this week's news. On Tuesday, one of Alaska's longtime leaders in Native and tribal health care passed away. Sally Smith of Dillingham succumbed to a long battle with cancer at the age of 70. Smith spent some five decades helping improve the quality and access to health care for Alaska Natives and Native Americans around the country, serving in numerous roles over her distinguished career. Smith was the chairman of the Bristol Bay Area Health Corporation for 22 of her 30 years on that board. Her son Jack Smith says despite the many awards his mother received, recognition was never something she sought.
My mother worked very hard, but she was a very modest person, and nothing she did was ever to receive an award. And that's a very Native Alaskan way of being. And she did everything to help Native Americans throughout the country, and I think not many people know the story, and she could be actually very happy with that because she was doing it just purely to help people, cancer, diabetes, and alcoholism and cancer.
Funeral services are planned for Sally Smith later this month in Anchorage and in Dillingham. On Tuesday, the state's local boundary commission met again to discuss the Dillingham and Menicotic annexation petitions, voting 3-2 to formally reconsider their December votes of approval. ECOC attorney Jim Baldwin made the request, saying the commissioners' votes had been faulty in substance and finalized with procedural error.
We're arguing that the written decision, which departed almost completely from your staff recommendations and the staff reports, that your findings basically do not satisfy the standards as appearing in the regulations. They violate a controlling principle of law that they have not been correctly interpreted or applied.
Attorneys for Menicotic and Dillingham argued otherwise, saying the commissioners had followed regulations, addressed all issues, and should not grant a, quote, do-over. The reconsideration request was granted by the vote of 3-2, and both petitions will be taken up again on January 24th to allow time to send them to the legislature if reapproved. Photo evidence shows that the rumbling Bogoslaw volcano has changed the shape and size of the uninhabited island it encompasses northwest of Unalaska. The tiny island is now even smaller, is shaped like a hook, and USGS scientist Chris Way Thomas says the photos also show it's covered in ash.
There's ash draping over everything. So there's a layer of fine, muddy-looking ash covering what was a partially vegetated island.
He estimates about a third of the island has been destroyed so far by this period of eruptions that began back in December. Alaska's Department of Environmental Conservation announced this week that after extensive testing, it can confirm that Alaska's seafood remains free of any radiation that could be linked to the Fukushima nuclear power plant. Since the 2011 earthquake and tsunami, there has been public concern about radiation affecting Pacific seafood, despite reassurances from food safety authorities. Marlena Brewer is a spokesperson with DEC.
Fishing is such a huge part of our lives here, so I think that there was just an overwhelming concern. They wanted to see, you know, Alaska-specific data.
Inspectors tested king, chum, sockeye, and pink salmon, as well as halibut, pollock, sablefish, herring, and Pacific cod, all from Alaska fisheries, and found no trace of Fukushima radiation. This week, the state of Alaska and the Anvik tribe signed an historic government-to-government pact to allow tribal courts to administer restorative sentences in some lower-level cases. This will serve as an alternative to the state criminal justice system, says KUAC reporter Dan Bross in Fairbanks.
It allows willing offenders, both tribal and non-tribal, to divert from state to a tribal court for lower level and first-time crimes, including domestic violence, alcohol, and drug offenses. Tribally administered penalties outlined under the agreement can include fines up to $1,500 or replacement of stolen or damaged property, but also include apology to those impacted by a crime. Offenders who refuse to comply with tribal court orders face prosecution in state court.
Anvik is the first of several tribes in the state expected to sign on to the new agreement. Senators Lisa Murkowski and Dan Sullivan introduced legislation this week that, if passed, will authorize construction of the controversial Eisenbeck Road. The single-lane, non-commercial gravel road has been long sought by residents of King Cove as the most reliable means to connect to the all-weather airstrip in Cold Bay. Opponents say the road will disturb sensitive habitat in a congressionally designated wilderness section of the Eisenbeck Refuge. The bill would allow for an equal value land swap between the federal and state governments and had the swift support of Alaska Governor Bill Walker. And outgoing Interior Secretary Sally Jewell announced 24 new National Historic Landmarks this week, and on the list is the Walrus Islands Archaeological District near Togiak. Long protected as a state game sanctuary, the ancient culture and human involvement at Round Island and the six other islands now has special recognition, so says National Park Service historian Janet Clemens.
Part of that significance is that it's considered one of the few remaining places that provide evidence of human occupation of the Bering Sea continental shelf when the sea levels were substantially lower than present, and that most of the evidence of other coastal prehistoric life Alaska is submerged and probably destroyed by ocean currents, so this makes it even more of a rare find.
Archaeologists say artifacts found at the Walrus Islands date to 6,000 years ago and are the oldest example of a human subsistence hunting relationship with walrus in North America. More on this week's news can be found at our website, kdlg.org. You're listening to Bristol Bay and Beyond on KDLG. I'm Dave Benninger. The state of Alaska released a report yesterday saying that a small HIV outbreak had been reported in a small rural village in the state, confirming the news that the Bristol Bay Area Health Corporation had published in a mailer earlier this month. Family Dr. Kathy Hyman joined yesterday to discuss.
Dr. Hyman, it is good to have you back. It's been a little too long.
It is a pleasure to be here.
Well, let's talk about something that's not fun news in any sort to talk about. But we noticed in a publication that came out that there's been an increase in reported cases of HIV. This caught the attention of folks. It's concerning. What can you break down for us?
There have been an increase in the number of cases of HIV in our region. We've had a total of 5 new cases over the diagnosed over the past 2 or 3 months.
What can you discuss about the reasons behind these cases? I know that I heard right away that this might be tied to intravenous drug use habits and such, but you say otherwise, perhaps.
HIV is spread through sharing of blood and body fluids. It could be happening by drug use, but it does not appear to be so in this particular group of cases. This particular group of cases seems to be associated with sexually transmitted vectors.
Do you have any advice for the public at large about HIV? I know sometimes it holds a mystique almost of concern, but that's not really a healthy mindset to have, right?
Right. HIV is treatable, but to be treated, you first have to be diagnosed. The biggest thing is get tested, because you don't know what you're facing till you have the information. And there are good treatments that allow people to live with HIV here in our own communities. And in terms of preventing HIV, use protection. The only protection that's available for sexually transmitted cases is wear condoms every time. Every time.
And as I've had you and Gina Carpenter in the past, we've talked about that's sort of where the drugs and alcohol might actually come into play, is not the needles so much as numbing one's good choices.
That's correct. It is frequent that when a person is intoxicated by alcohol, they make more poor choices. Or, unfortunately, in some cases, their choice is taken away from them by the alcohol. They may be even passed out and not even know that they are having sex with somebody or somebody's having sex with them.
That was Dr. Kathy Hyman. We'll have her on again later in the show to talk about some healthy living tips for the new year ahead. As for the HIV story, state health officials say limited access to health care and health education, as well as patient concerns about stigma and confidentiality, can often be barriers to routine testing in rural Alaska. Over the past 5 years, an average of 28 newly diagnosed cases of HIV have been reported in the state. A majority of them, 54%, involve men who have sex with men, most of whom live in urban areas of Alaska. A couple of months back on this show, we had former Dillingham Superior Court Judge Pat Douglas on as a guest. While she was here, she discussed some of the problems she has seen with the rollout of the state's major set of criminal justice reforms known as SB 91. They were sponsored by Fairbanks and North Pole Senator John Coghill, who has much to say about their merits, some of which we'll post online at kdlg.org. For this program today, I asked Coghill first about what has not gone so smoothly in his mind since SB 91 went into effect last summer.
Well, we changed our pretrial and our probation parole. Those were going to be a little longer implementation. But what happened immediately was when you're first charged with something, you can bail yourself out. And we changed the way we were doing bail so that it was based on a risk assessment. And what's happening is it looks to me like, and why some of the judges and some of the prosecutors are unhappy, is those risk assessments have not taken maturity yet. And so we're having people come out who have been doing crimes, and rightfully so. The police and the victims are wearied that these guys come right back out on the street again. And that has not been as smooth a transition as we should have probably thought through. We might want to have had a better timing of some of those issues, because our pretrial services don't even get started until probably mid-January this year. That is going to be that if the risk assessment tool says you're a danger to society or you're going to be a habitual offender, that there's a diversion program you'd be pointed to. Well, that diversion program is not in place yet. So that has been, to me, it looks like one of the places where people have legitimate criticisms. And, people who are less than honorable can game that system, and I think they have.
Okay. There's another concern that's been raised about, I don't know all the mechanics of it, but I get the sense that both pretrial and post-conviction, there is hope that there will be more supervised release, more treatment, more rehab options rather than incarceration. What about the fact that some of those services are either sparse or do not exist in the bush? How will that work?
You know, that's going to be the growing pains. There's no doubt. In order to have the money to put into programs, you've got to save the money. And so we were hoping that by doing some of these pretrial issues with supervision that's already available, like ankle monitoring and things like that, that we would be able to divert the cash into programs that people could apply for. And so we started it with some cash, but it's a fair statement that Anchorage, Juneau, Fairbanks, probably some of the hub communities like Bethel probably will do a little better because they have some service capacity already that they can grow off of. That is going to be a growing pain. But I will say this, you just take what we weren't doing before, we have the same problem. So we have to find ways to get money into programs. And yes, it's going to take time and effort, I think it's worthwhile.
Something
if you can lower, if you can lower the crime rate, it's worth a while.
Something the outgoing judge, an issue along those lines she raised as she spoke with us was that constitutionally you can't mandate a person relocate to seek treatment. What does a person do in New Stoyahawk or Togiak or Dillingham if that if those services don't exist here? What's the general theory behind that that aspect?
Well, we need to get services. Some of them are going to be community-based. And so one of the things that I have done is I put forward a bill last year, Senate Bill 117, that creates a, in statute, a mechanism where courts can divert to tribal courts for misdemeanors and some of the both civil and some of the criminal elements so that your restorative justice, your talking circles, things like that, where community accountability is used, can be just as effective. That did not go anywhere. I'm going to set that in motion again this year because I think we have to have the state and the tribal groups working together to change the way our society is going. It's just going to have to be a part of it. So you can't deliver services necessarily from outside of the city, but you can draw the services from inside the communities to make a safer community. And so that's going to be something I'm going to pitch as a chairman of judiciary this year.
All right. Two of the main areas that I've heard complaints about is the sort of structured sentence range for technical violations of probation. I think it's 3, 5, and 10 or something like that, the days in jail. That this will be problematic for the enforcement of probation, especially involving bush communities where if the VPSO in New Stoyahawk reports to adult probation that so-and-so is drinking again and shouldn't be, it's going to take a plane flight and yada, 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 and that first 2 days or that first 3 days or whatever just really won't have a lot of effect. I hear that as a complaint, and I wonder if you could react to that, but also I hear that the way that the drug crimes have sort of been restructured. And I would offer that most people don't want to see every drug user behind bars, but the police enforce drugs based on very small doses that are bought or sold. Maybe one dose bought or sold is enough leverage to either turn a buyer into a confidential informant or put a dealer for selling that one dose behind bars for enough time to sort of rid the community of them for a bit. Are either Go ahead.
Those are legitimate issues, and I think as we put the bill forward, I think there is going to be some modification coming forward. The police who have that problem that you just last stated is a worthwhile discussion that did not get as deeply involved in making the law as it could have. And then Anchorage has the ability to enforce probation parole violations very, very differently than New Stoyahawk, for example.
What you're saying is this is not a done deal. There are changes and tweaks and modifications likely coming here, I would suspect, in this next session.
Sure. The system that we have, it is called a criminal justice system, is really a legal system that sometimes is really just and sometimes is not. And this is going to be an ongoing process, just like bargaining sentences, because you can't afford to prosecute everything. We've got to change some of those behaviors. We have to do better than we're doing now. And so my focus is going to be, where can we do better? So I'll be listening to judges like the person who, registered a complaint about the service delivery. Those are legitimate complaints that we need to bring to the policy discussion and continually make it better. So this is not a one-time fix. This is a system way of looking at how can we hold people accountable, reduce the crime rate, but not do it the most expensive way that has not proven effective.
Senator John Coghill, sponsor of SB 91 and member of the Senate Judiciary Committee. Senator, thanks so much.
Thank you, Dave.
Well, a big part of the philosophy behind SB 91 is that as a society, we're better off not leaving people in jail if there are better ways for them to rehabilitate from behavior or past crime. Once in a while, we see a person who proves exactly that can be done, like 30-year-old Kelly Hoffman.
I got a felony. It's my first-time felony, so I was gifted, I guess you could say, with the SIS deal because it was my first one.
Hoffman was arrested in 2013 for possession and intent to sell heroin and methamphetamines. 2 years later, she sat down with us to talk about her time in jail, her road to recovery, and her road to sobriety. The last piece of her rehabilitation, as far as the state criminal justice system is concerned, was to complete the SIS.
And SIS is suspended imposition of sentence, and that is if you go through your entire probation, and mine was 3 years, and basically you just do what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to check in on time. You're supposed to give clean UAs when asked, and just live a clean and good life.
And that's exactly what she did, says both Hoffman and her probation officer, Rex Spofford.
Kelly had made the changes. She made the changes that were set before her by the court, and she used those opportunities to her advantage, and as a result was able to successfully complete probation and move forward in a much more positive direction in her life.
In 2013, Hoffman agreed to plead guilty and at that time became a convicted felon. The SIS will remove the felony conviction from a person's record after completion of the probation. But in the meantime, Hoffman says she lived as a felon with the lack of rights that entails.
Voting was one of them. When you're a felon, or like my case, just on probation, SIS. Like a passport, that's another thing. You can't get your passport. You can't leave. Like, if you, you know. I mean, I could barely get out of Dillingham without asking, you know, my probation officer. So no contact with felons. I can't own any firearms. I think switchblades. I couldn't, you know, or gravity knives. I don't even know what that is. And so I couldn't be around any, you know, just basically any weapons or anything like that.
She missed voting in the 2016 election by just 1 week. Spofford turned in the paperwork showing her completion of supervised probation on November 15th. And that was 2 months early, which is at the discretion of he can exercise when he sees people use the time to make the right changes in their lives.
That's what probation is about. It's really about slowing life down a little bit for folks, giving them some opportunities to look at life through a little bit different lens, hopefully a non-alcohol or drug-induced lens, and give them a chance to make changes for the better.
Not everyone succeeds on probation, and many who are given the SIS option end up with the felony on their record for falling short on supervision. Hoffman got sober, got good work, got married, and has another child. She's been putting away money and steering far clear of old temptations. Now she and her family are heading south to start a new chapter in their lives, and she's doing so without the felony conviction.
You know, I'm not a bad person for what I did. I did a bad thing. That doesn't deem me a bad person for the rest of my life. For the most part, there's not bad people. There's just bad things, bad doings, bad choices. If I can do this, if I can definitely do a mistake, learn from it, you know, complete my probation, everything like that, of course, absolutely someone else can do this. And I'm happy that I'm a picture out there that people can just look at and just be like, look, if she can do it, oh my gosh, you know, anybody else, I could do it.
This is Bristol Bay and Beyond, back in a moment. Dog sledding has an important place in the storied past of this region. I've been reading John Branson and Alaska Geographic books and keep stumbling on incredible tales of trappers who hitched up their teams and headed out for the winter. Well, today it seems more of a hobby than anything else, and it seems to be dying at that. It's been 3 years since the last locally hosted race that we're aware of. KDLG's Avery Lill spoke with some local mushers for more on why it's a fading pastime.
You can hear the dog yards in New Stuyahok before you can see them. Dozens of canines howl, excited by the sound of a snow machine pulling up to the kennel.
Dozer, and here's Lady, Angel, Muckluck, and Yana, Penny, Ginger.
John Hansen Jr. is one of four dog mushers in New Stuyahok, probably the most active mushing community in a region that has watched participation in the tradition dwindle.
These other mushers are elderly mushers, and they were in it for 40, 50, 60 years or more. And I don't see any young mushers around in the Bristol Bay region, you know, getting involved in dog mushing.
Part of the reason, he tells me, is dogs take a lot of work. Hansen collects food scraps from neighbors every day. The aroma of fish and moose guts in the steel drum where he cooks the dog's food is pungent. When there's snow, he runs the dogs on a sled. When there isn't, the dogs pull him on a four-wheeler. The recent lack of good snow has been the other main problem for mushers.
They say there's more snow a long time ago. You know, they talk about lots of snow and colder.
For Hansen, caring for dogs is a full-time job. He lives on money from sponsors and dividend checks from the state's permanent fund and Native Corporation. But it's an uncertain income. This year, Hansen has struggled to find sponsors in the area. It's been a few years since weather has allowed a race in Bristol Bay, and he's not optimistic that this year will be any better. Without races, people in business in the area are less interested in sponsoring local mushers. So he looks to other parts of Alaska, like the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta, to sponsor his team and his travel to their races. He'll be traveling to the Kuskokwim next week, where he says not only are there plenty of races, but interest is growing. Local mushers say that the sport has been on the decline in Bristol Bay well before the years of light snow. Kyle Bilek keeps three old mushing dogs in Dillingham. His dogs might be 12 years old, but they still love to pull. As they cut their way through the frosty tundra, he says he feels at home with his dogs, outside of a snow machine's bubble of noise and exhaust. Bilek has run a few races, but he says he started keeping dogs more for the history of it. He likes the idea that before it was a sport, many families in the area kept dogs as draft animals for travel and hauling.
You know, everybody had dogs because that's what they had to have. That's how they got around. That's how they hauled wood. That's how they went hunting. That's when how they traveled. That's how they did everything. You know, when I was growing up here in the, you know, 70s and 80s and 90s, there were dog yards all over the place.
Better roads and more snow machines turned dog sledding into more of a hobby than a necessity. Bleck also believes that the decline can be attributed to a time in the 70s when people first began importing dogs for racing.
When guys first started importing dogs, they imported all the other things that came with dogs, and among that was disease. And so there were massive die-offs in the villages. Some guys lost their entire genetic line to parvo and distemper. That sort of coincided with snow machines becoming available, and that double whammy really, really hit things hard.
And then came the recent years without snow.
You know, the last 3 years, it was darn near treacherous, and this year it's not that bad, although I fell in some creeks back here behind the house a couple of weeks ago, and just the weather's changing. And so, you know, with sled dogs, if you can't, there's so much work and there's so much effort that if you can't use them, there's really no point to having them.
Bleck has kept dogs for his entire adult life. Despite his love of mushing and his passion for its history, the empty wooden kennels in his dog yard show that even he has sold or given away most of his team.
But what happened to mushing? What happens to a lot of old things? They just get replaced. And then, you know, I think the weather has kind of been the nail in the coffin, at least in Bristol Bay.
Dog teams might be louder, messier, and more time-consuming than snow machines, and you can't throw a tarp on them when the snow melts. But Hansen and Bleck are among a dozen or so holdouts working to keep the tradition alive in Bristol Bay. If Mother Nature cooperates and Dillingham is able to host their annual race at the Spring Beaver Roundup, some younger residents could be inspired to step onto sleds of their own. In Dillingham, I'm Avery Lill.
Something we've done the past 2 years on this show is ask some of our medical provider friends to offer some healthy living advice. You know, the resolutions we love to make and break this time of the year. Dr. Kathy Heineman knows us, knows what we're doing wrong and not doing right, and her advice again this year is surprisingly simple.
We all need to move more. That is probably the biggest thing that a given person can do, aside from quitting smoking, to improve their health and well-being over the long run. We all adults are supposed to get 30 minutes of moderate exercise a day. Moderate exercise means walking. It doesn't mean running. It means walking. And you can break up that exercise into patches of 10 minutes at a time. I frequently recommend that for folks who are working at a place that gives them a 15-minute break in the morning and in the afternoon, that they spend that 15 minutes walking somewhere, anywhere. Children should be getting 60 minutes of active exercise every day. We are seeing an increased number of obese children, and that will lead them to health problems down the road that if their parents can help make a change by encouraging their kids to play, going out and playing with their kids, and controlling the foods that come into the house, can all make real benefits in the long run for these children.
When you talk about that walking, and now we have a little bit of snow out there to snowshoe or ski or such, but I have noticed you on the roadside walking. Have you encountered any difficulties to keeping that up as a healthy habit?
I am dedicated, right at the moment at least, to exercising every day. However, since I get home after just about dark time or a little bit after dark, I must admit it's hard for me to get myself out on that ice to walk. I like the teeth I have left. And so I will often do my exercise on the treadmill in the evening. However, on the weekends, when I do have time during the daylight, I've been going out on the tundra and doing some cross-country skiing, getting some of that natural light on my eyes, which is another important thing that people can do in this dark time. Even just getting outside for 10 or 15 minutes will help your body recognize daytime, help you sleep better at nighttime, and help lighten the load of depression.
Why is this little bit of exercise, even just so much as 30 minutes of walking, why and what health problems do you see that could help improve for many of us that sit much too much in a day?
The major problems with sitting too much is weight gain leading to diabetes, leading to heart disease, leading to hypertension. All of these things can be positively affected by exercise. For instance, I have been diagnosed with prediabetes. Makes me mad. I want to eat whatever I want to eat, but turns out I can't. However, over the year that I've been diagnosed, I have been conscious of walking more and choosing better what I eat, and happily, my numbers have improved significantly. So I know for sure that exercise is helping me.
Dr. Kathy Heineman, it's good to have you in the studio as always, and here's to a happy and healthy 2017. It won't be until 2018 that we see you next, but thanks as always.
My pleasure.
And that's just about it for this week's show. You can find this and past episodes of Bristol Bay and Beyond at our website, kdlg.org. Send feedback and story ideas to dave@kdlg.org. I'm Dave Benninger. My thanks to Avery Lill for her help this week. We'll take next Friday off to make room for the coverage of the Sockeye Classic tournament, basketball tournament that will happen here in downtown Dillingham. But before we go this week, we'll leave you with this audio postcard from some of the Slavi starring. Here is KDLG's Avery Lill, followed the electing gig star to the Dillingham Hotel.
Christus, I am done about you.
I'm Father Michael Nicolai, and I'm a local priest here in Dillingham. The three wise men, they followed the star to where the young child was, and that's where they found the Christ. And we follow that same pattern, and we're going to these people's houses that are accepting Christ into their own home. You know, all these things are kind of played out exactly the same way the Bible is.
My name is Mabel, and my maiden last name is Krause. Changes I've seen over the Slavic thing is completely different from the old time. It's more modern. You're running around in cars and snow machines instead of dog teams. I grew up with dog teams back in the day, and that was a lot of fun. We even went from village to village as it continues on to this day. We go from house to house. I could remember going from Alicknagik to Dillingham and then to Clark's Point, you know, because it was right in within, you know, where it's safe to go with your dog teams and still know they're going to be fed and whatever. And now it's the younger generation, and so I've seen a lot of changes. And I'm very proud of some of these kids because of the way they kept the old tradition. It's a joyous time of the year, you know. You're singing the birth of Christ. You're rejoicing in Christ being born.